Seattle, Washington, this is VOA News. I'm Steve Norman reporting. Series of explosions hit a military academy in Afghanistan's capital, Kabul, which has been the target of several insurgent attacks recently. At least two are dead there, at least 10 are wounded. Sunday, Afghanistan held a national day of mourning the day after insurgents used an explosives-laden ambulance to carry out a suicide attack, killing 103 and leaving 235 wounded in Kabul. We ask Indiana University Central Asia scholar Nazif Sirani if Pakistan is complicit in these recent attacks.
Absolutely, absolutely. There is no doubt about anybody's mind in Afghanistan that these are done by the order of Pakistan. Pakistanis make a point to Trump, don't push us too much and we can cause more harm.
President Trump lashed out at Pakistan in early January, denouncing Islamabad's, as he put it, lies and deceit in the fight against terrorism, with the U.S. suspending hundreds of millions of dollars in security assistance. The 30th African Union Summit underway in Addis Ababa, among those attending, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres.
I stand here on behalf of the United Nations system and reaffirm our strong commitment to the member states and the people of Africa. I strongly believe Africa is one of the greatest forces for good in our world.
55 heads of state are attending, and the theme of this year's meeting, fight against corruption. Yemen's prime minister is accusing southern separatists of coup after they seized several government buildings during fighting Sunday and government forces in the port city of Aden. The fighting, which has killed at least 10, broke out when President Abu Rabu Mansour Hadi ignored separatist demands to fire the prime minister for corruption. This is VOA News. Turkish forces and their Syrian rebel allies claim to have seized Mount Barsaya near the Kurdish town of Afrin in northwest Syria as they press their week-old offensive to clear the Turkish-Syrian frontier of Kurdish militia viewed as a security threat. Meantime, Russia hosting a summit in Sochi beginning today. They are calling it the Black Sea Peace Congress. American actor and UN social envoy Angelina Jolie has called on the world leaders to find a solution to the Syrian crisis. Her comments came during a visit to the Za'atari refugee camp in Jordan.
After 7 years of war, most Syrian refugees have exhausted any savings they had. The vast majority of them already live below the poverty line on less than $3 a day. If you imagine what that would mean for your family here it means families going without sufficient food, children unable to get medical treatment, young girls vulnerable to early marriage, and many Syrians facing yet another winter without proper shelter.
Jordan currently hosts more than 1.4 million Syrian refugees, most of them living in urban areas, around 100,000 in camps. Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny has been released from police detention in Moscow after thousands of pro-opposition marchers rallied against a March election expected to extend President Vladimir Putin's term in the Kremlin. They, like Navalny, have called it pseudo-election. Police arrested Navalny while he was on his way to an unauthorized rally. Here in the U.S., key Republicans have voiced strong support for Special Counsel Robert Mueller's handling of the investigation into Russian meddling in the 2016 presidential election, but split on whether Congress needs to approve legislation to block President Trump from firing Mueller. Senator Susan Collins of Maine, breaking with some of her Republican colleagues, favoring legislation to require judicial review if Mr. Trump were to dismiss Mueller. Senator Collins appeared on the CBS program Face the Nation.
The president cannot directly fire Mr. Mueller. The only person who has that authority is the Deputy Attorney General, Rod Rosenstein, and he's the one who appointed Mr. Mueller in the first place. I asked him about that at a hearing last year, and he was adamant that he would resist any White House pressure to fire Mr. Mueller.
President Trump last week reiterated his long-standing contention that there was no collusion between him and Russian interests to help him defeat his Democratic challenger in the 2016 election. Get more news at our website. You can find us at voanews.com.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Monday, the 29th day of January, and here are some of the stories we are covering. There are fresh calls for sanctions against those impeding peace in South Sudan, but the government denies it is doing so.
The government has a moral obligation to ensure peace comes back to South Sudan, and therefore, we are not one of the violators of the peace agreement.
Atain Wek Atain is the spokesman for South Sudan President Salva Kiir. The African Union welcomes three new presidents, including Liberia's new president George Weah. Escalating violence in Cameroon's English-speaking region spurs large number of refugees. And Burundi's government accommodates thousands fleeing violence in the Democratic Republic of Congo.
We know that DRC, there is a war. We can receive also people who have lost the war, and soldiers or rebels, they can come. That is why we say that we have to be vigilant.
Juvenal Bigirimana is the governor of Burundi's Rumonge province, and northern Senegal gets ready for the opening of this year's Open Sahel Festival. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley Sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. South Sudan's government has again said it is not violating the ceasefire and therefore not impeding peace. This comes as there are renewed calls for sanctions on those blocking the peace process in South Sudan. Speaking Sunday at the African Union Summit in Addis Ababa, African Union Commission Chair Moussa Faki Mahamat deployed what he called unbelievable cruelty and senseless violence in South Sudan and said it was time to impose sanctions. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres promised UN support for stronger measures, but Atain Wek Atain, the spokesman for South Sudan President Salva Kiir, says the government has a moral obligation to ensure that peace comes to South Sudan. He blames rebels loyal to Riek Machar for violating the ceasefire agreement.
When His Excellency Musa spoke of imposing sanction on those who would be forcing his stumbling block on the implementation of peace agreement, he did it to encourage the stakeholders to make sure that they come up with something that will bring peace to South Sudan. So it is doing it in anticipation of the oncoming revitalization process in Addis Ababa.
Well, again, your government is the one involved. You're a party to the violence that is going on. And almost everyone now is deploring this violence. You, as the government, you see your role also in this? That when there are any sanctions, they will have to affect your government, people in your government.
No, that's the assumption. If there is any party in peace agreement that is looking for peace, is the government. Because the government has a moral duty to ensure that peace is in the country. But because the rebels have nothing to lose, they are not morally obliged to make peace, you know, since they are enjoying the issue of two sides being condemned spontaneously. But the government has a moral obligation to ensure peace comes back to South Sudan. And therefore, we are not one of the violators of the peace agreement. But what the international community must do is to devise a mechanism that will tell them exactly who has, in this case, violated the agreement, but not this generalizing notion of accusing the two sides at the same time.
Even if you say your government is not violating the ceasefire agreement, your government has been adamant of not allowing Riek Machar to come and be part of the peace process because you claim he's not interested in peace. By doing that, you are prolonging the war.
I don't know what is Riek Machar in all this. When people talk of Riek Machar as if Riek Machar is, as a person, should be the one that, if he is not involved in the peace process, then the peace will not come to the country. This challenges the intelligence of those who have this in mind, simply because Riek Machar as a person, and if you look at the remnants of, or the pockets of rebels, of the rebellion, that is, Riek Machar still has in the country that are loyal to Riek Machar, they are very insignificant. They cannot continue to foot the country into war if the international community is serious to address this quickly. But if people are thinking that Riek Machar is the one who has a key to peace in South Sudan, that is why the assumption is always so serious.
It seems that the whole international community is angry with everyone, the parties to the conflict in South Sudan. The U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, Nikki Haley, said last week that your government was increasingly proving itself to be an unfit partner in the efforts to restore peace.
Well, the remark of Ambassador Nikki Haley was an outrageous comment, given that Nikki Haley is always, you know, caught up in a controversy since she started to be the United States representative to the United Nations. You know, less than a year ago, she has been caught in controversy by the fact that she only picked up anything she gets and started accusing government for it without investigating it and find exactly the real thing she's talking about. So it was very unfortunate that she reached a conclusion we was uncalled for. And we thought it is necessary that for the purpose of cementing our relationship between United States of America and South Sudan, as we in South Sudan, we think United States of America midwife South Sudan, and we cannot allow our relationship with the United States to go sour. So when an individual leader from United States comes out with such outrageous statement, which is always shocking for us.
Atain Wekatain, spokesman for South Sudan President Salva Kiir. You're speaking with me from the capital, Juba. Liberia's newly inaugurated President George Weah was one of three new African leaders welcomed at the just-concluded African Union Summit in Ethiopia's capital, Addis Ababa. The other two were Zimbabwe's Emmerson Mnangagwa and João Lourenço of Angola. The summit focused on fighting corruption in order to uphold Africa's vision in achieving development. Liberia's Information Minister Eugene Nnaboye said President Weah received a rousing welcome as he presented Liberia's vision on the fight against corruption and many other topics.
It was a very successful meeting for President Weah, this being his first outing since he took over as President of the Republic of Liberia. In fact, he was welcomed to a rousing round of applause by President Conle and the other leaders. And then he was also allowed to make a statement, his first statement, before the authorities of heads of state. And he used the opportunity to thank the AU for the help that he's been giving to Liberia, Liberia itself being a founding member. And then he plunged right into the discussion, which centered around key issues, including the fight against corruption, illicit migration, peace and security on the continent. And Mr. Weah was very active in his participation.
You said he plunged right into the key discussion, which was the fight against corruption. You know, I am looking at some of the criticism that people have given him so far, and that is whether the fight against corruption, how to deal with it. People say, well, he should have declared his assets, including even his ministers, they should declare their assets. That would be a good start for the fight against corruption.
Under Liberian law, Mr. Weah did declare his assets, both when he was running for the Liberian Senate and then after he became senator, he declared all of his assets. And then again, when he sought to ascend to the presidency, under the elections law, he also had to declare his assets, and he did that. It's also a law that all ministers, appointed officials, have to declare their assets. And there is no way that any minister or any appointed official of the government is going to avoid doing what is legal. So all can rest assured that this will happen. But President Weah's attitude towards corruption is a little bit different from the conventional approach. What he said at the AU meeting was that instead of focusing on people to not be corrupt, we should strengthen institutions that have the capacity to be both preventive and in some cases punitive. Once we have the right systems in place, then Africa and the rest of the world can deal with the scourge of corruption very easily. And he also urged the AU itself to put a lot of resources into dealing with some of the elements that lead to corruption and also to strengthen the institutions in our various countries so that corruption can be dealt with in a very effective manner.
Minister Nnaboye, I saw the list as the president continues to make new appointments, and I see a lot of young people, to the point that somebody told me some of them may still be in college or the university. What is behind this, the appointment of a lot of these young people?
Firstly, if you look at the demographic composition of our country, we have almost 70% of all Liberians being under the age of 35. And it is this same composition of our demography that led the drive for President Weah to get elected. And these people are the face of his election. So it is clear that by electing President Weah, he also was in the know that those who were his supporters, majority of them being young people, will also play a part in the governance of the country. So this is not surprising. Yes, it is true that some of them are still in universities, but they have proven over the years that they possess the skills for leadership and the skills to deliver.
Eugene Nambwe is Liberia's information minister. He was speaking with me from the Ethiopian capital, Addis Ababa. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Monday, the 29th day of January. And please send your comments and opinions to Daybreak Africa at voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is 15 minutes past the hour. More than 7,000 Congolese have fled their country into Burundi since last week. This comes after the DRC government launched a major attack on the Mai Mai rebel stronghold. Moses Javier Rimana has this story.
In the searing heat of the day, refugees fleeing Democratic Republic of Congo are selling off their belongings, mostly goats and ducks, to earn some money for a living at the port in Rumonge. Rumonge province is located in the southern part of the country on the shores of Lake Tanganyika, which separates Burundi and Democratic Republic of Congo. Since last week, more than 7,000 Congolese have fled the war that erupted between their government and the Mai Mai rebellion in the southern Kivu. They say that they spend more than 5 hours on boats before crossing into Burundi. Bunge Semfore is a 54-year-old man who is seeking refuge in Burundi. He says he fled fighting between the Mai Mai and the government. Bunge says he was working in South Kivu before fleeing for his life. He said he came to Burundi for a safer place before leaving for Uvira, where his family is located. The Congolese refugees looked very tired, hungry and angry as they awaited to be transported to the transit camps provided by the Burundi government. They say they have been stranded here for more than 2 days without significant help. I met one of the women here who says she is a mother of 4 children. She says they are suffering in Burundi as they are not getting water and food. She says they were told to look for food and that how can they get food as they are refugees in Burundi. This is not the first time the Congolese government has carried out major attacks against the Mai Mai rebels. Last year, 2 rebel boats were sunk by Congolese army, according to the DRC government. Juvenal Bigirimana, the governor of Rumonge, said the Burundian government is doing what it can to accommodate the refugees.
We know that DRC there is a war. We can receive also people who have lost the war, and soldiers or rebels, they can come. That is why we say that we have to be vigilant, and we have to keep our security here in our country. That is why we have to put them together and give them to the UNHCR team.
According to the US-based Human Rights Watch, political violence and government repression continued as President Joseph Kabila holds on to power beyond his constitutionally mandated 2-term limit, which ended in December 2016. The inter-ethnic violence and clashes between the regular army, militia and armed groups has left at least 1.3 million people displaced in eastern DRC's provinces of Lake Tanganyika and South Kivu. Moses Javier Imana, VOA Africa, Rumonge in Burundi.
Simultaneous attacks by suspected armed separatists have been taking place in Cameroon's 2 English-speaking regions, with casualties among both the military and armed separatists. The Cameroon government says several of its soldiers and dozens of separatists have been killed. Several villages have been burned and thousands of people have fled. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from the northwestern town of Kumbo, where the latest casualties have been reported.
30 villagers, a majority of them children, have sought refuge at a building owned by the Roman Catholic Church in Tadu, a village near the English-speaking northwestern town of Kumbo. 3 senior women struggled to take care of them. Caroline Ngong, 24, who is nursing her newborn, says she ran to the church building since she could not escape because of the poor health of her 3-month-old baby. She says the Cameroon military attacked her village and started shooting indiscriminately.
Just of a sudden, we saw the military arresting people, shooting others, and others were wounded. They caught some people, and others were taken to the gendarme, and some escaped to bushes. Sebastian, how can they come and just be arresting people when they have not said what the problem is? People do not know a reason behind that arresting and shooting.
Last Wednesday, citizens of Kumbu awoke to find leaflets reportedly from a group calling itself a resistance army that supports the total independence of the English-speaking regions from the French-speaking regions of Cameroon. The leaflets called for the population to assist in driving out or eliminating the military deployed by Cameroon President Paul Biya to fight separatists. As a result of the threats, the military presence in Kumbu was reinforced and the troops searched homes and arrested people suspected of belonging to the resistance group. The government says a soldier with the Cameroonian armed forces was killed in Tadu and another was wounded in an attack by armed separatists last Wednesday. Prudence Lenyui, who works with the Catholic Church's humanitarian outreach program in Tadu, says the military countered the attack and a majority, more than 80% of the nearly 1,000 people in Tadu and surrounding villages fled.
The military invaded the whole area and in the course of it, an old woman lost her life. And this has caused the population to escape. They are afraid of torture, arrest and all that. It's a situation that we as inhabitants really are so worried about. And the problem is we don't know for how long this will continue.
Similar attacks also were reported simultaneously in several other villages in the English-speaking northwest and southwest regions. Several villages were also burned. Issa Chiruma, Cameroon's government spokesperson, said the villagers' claims that government soldiers were responsible for the torched villages were unfounded. He accused armed separatists. The unrest in Cameroon began in November 2016 when English-speaking teachers and lawyers in the northwest and southwest regions, frustrated by having to use the French language, took to the streets, calling for reforms and greater autonomy. It degenerated with separatists calling for independence. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Kumbu, northwestern Cameroon.
The festival at Sahel Ouvert, or Open Sahel Festival, is gearing up for its fourth edition in northern Senegal this February. The music event will bring together artists from all over the continent to a small town, Mbumba. Visitors to the festival pay to stay with local families rather than in hotels, which both provides a unique experience and boosts the local economy. Director Xavier Simoni talked to Ricky Stryak about how the festival is impacting local residents by building a school and theater.
The first year it was only Poulard Art. And the second year we had artists from all over Senegal. And last year we extended to Sahel. So we had artists from Nigeria, from Mauritania, and so forth. And this year was exciting because of the success we can extend to the continent. So we're bringing artists from Maghreb, from Morocco, and also Bonga, which is a big star, from Angola.
And how does your festival work to build cultural infrastructure in the region where you put on the event?
Every year we are doing things, and now the success make the people from the area, thousands of people ask to the village where we're doing this along the year, can we come and do theater or music or dance or whatever? Part of this process of development through culture, we said this year, okay, so we are going to build a theater. And so a theater is, I'm telling you now, right now, we are building a theater in the middle of the bush. And it's going to be a great celebration this year because this will be the first time we're using it next month for all the population that want to become artists or to together with all the people along the year, not only during the festival.
Are there other initiatives that will help enable people to put on events in this theater throughout the year? I see that there's an art school that maybe you guys are helping build.
Yeah, that's the goal. I mean, the festival is only an event. So it comes and it goes. It's not an event just to show artists. It's an event to celebrate what we are doing all year long. In fact, all year long, we are in this area, in the northern part of Senegal, and we are preserving culture by using its traditional culture, by using it through cultures, theater, dance, music, or movies, and make, pieces of art, more than contemporary pieces of art. That's the first thing we do. But doing that, we are just seeing who wants to be an artist, but who wants to be a technician, who wants to be a project leader, who wants to be a webmaster, who wants to be, and so on.
That was Xavier Simoni, director of the festival of Sahel Uverd. He was speaking to Ricky Stryak from Dakar. It's 25 minutes past the hour. Time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. And here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. Very good Monday morning to you, Samson.
Good Monday morning to you, James. We begin in Morocco, where the semifinal pairings for the African Nations Championship CHAN, a tournament for the continent's locally based players, was concluded this past weekend. Super Eagles of Nigeria came from behind to beat Angola 2-1 in one of the quarterfinal matches played on Sunday through substitute Gabriel Okechukwu in the 108th minute to book a place in the semifinals. Nigeria will now play Sudan in Wednesday's second semi-final in Marrakesh. Salisu Yusuf, coach of the Super Eagles, has expressed satisfaction at his team's qualification.
We are very happy. If you observe, Angola qualified as quarterfinal with only one goal. So it's not the matter of how many goals you score. It's a matter of you are not conceding and you can score one and qualify. I think that's the most important.
In the other late kickoff on Sunday, Libya progressed into the semi-finals of the 2018 African Nations Championship after beating Congo 5-3 in a penalty shootout after their quarterfinal match ended 1-1. Libya will now meet host Morocco, who defeated Namibia 2-0 in Casablanca in the first semi-finals on Wednesday. And on to women's football, where Nigeria and Ghana will represent the continent yet again at the FIFA Under-20 Women's World Cup after they respectively edged South Africa and Cameroon on Saturday. The Falcons of Nigeria beat Besiktas 6-0 and 8-0 on aggregate, whilst Ghana Princesses won 3-0 against their Cameroonian counterpart to claim the other slot 4-1 on aggregate. After a qualification process that involved 17 teams in Africa, Ghana and Nigeria came out tops to return to the global finals, which will take place in France from the 5th to the 24th of August. Yusufu Basigi is the coach of the Black Princess of Ghana.
Well, it was my dream to qualify to the World Cup. I knew it was not going to be easy because for qualifiers, you can't underestimate any country. Because now the women or the other all countries are of age when you talk of women football. So you don't have to underestimate any country. I knew I could qualify, but it was not going to be easy task.
We Ghana, and let's tell you that Ghana's Premier League champions, Aduana Stars, have lifted the first trophy of the 2017-2018 football season after defeating Asante Kotoko by a lone goal in the Super Cup in Obuasi. The Super Cup, the traditional season opener, pits the league champions against winners of the FA Cup, and Aduana proved their might against the Porcupine Warriors. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good day. And that is it for this Monday, January 29th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for starting your week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing you in Africa a very, very productive week.
The State of the Union Address is an important annual message delivered by the President of the United States to a joint session of the United States Congress. VOA will provide complete coverage of President Donald Trump's first State of the Union speech, along with a Democratic response, beginning Wednesday, January 31st at 1:45 UTC.
Music time in Africa. Savor the flavor of African music. Hi, I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Tune in, feast your ears, and dig in to an hour of amazing Pan-African music, featured interviews, and music news. Music Time in Africa, Friday at 0900 and Saturday and Sunday at 0900, 15, 20, and 2200 hours UTC.